This episode of Standard Orbit is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, everyone, to Standard Orbit, Trek FM's dedicated podcast that covers the original series. My name is Ken Tripp, and we have yet another fantastic show for all of our red shirts out there in Trek FM land. Tonight, I am covering for the great Norman Lau, who is on assignment for his other full-time job, ensuring he has a secure income in order to purchase collectibles and then give them away during contests when he makes a mistake on the air. He's a good guy. And I'm privileged to work with the host and the star of Standard Orbit, our own Mr. Atos, Jeffrey Harlan. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. I'm just getting over some more of that time lag. You know, just bouncing back between the centuries.
It's not easy. It's a tough time of year, especially when you're doing time travel to stay healthy. Hopefully you're taking plenty of vitamin C.
Oh, yes.
Okay. That's what we need to hear. So today's show, we're going to be taking a look at the Commodores in the original series. And this is a very interesting subject. This was Norman Lau's suggestion. And he sent us some information of things that he wanted covered and some things that we were going to put together for you. And it's a very, I think, unique thing to talk about because Commodores really didn't pull into the other Star Trek series or movies. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to run through a quick history of the rank and title of Commodore and how it impacted our timeline, meaning the last century or so. And then we'll get into talking about the different Commodore characters that have made their appearances on the original series. So just so everybody's aware, the term Commodore in both the U.S. and British Navy was given to the senior ranking captain. So the person who had the rank of captain who was commanding more than one ship or a squadron or unit. So before World War II, the navies, the British and the U.S. Navy, there were only three levels of admiral. There was a rear admiral, a vice admiral, and an admiral. And during World War II, after immense buildup of the fleet and to better align with the Army and Marine Corps, who had four levels of general, if you remember that saying, be my little general, brigadier general, lieutenant general, major general, and general, the Navy made the Commodore rank official, and it was essentially a one-star admiral. Now, after the war, the rank was removed about 3 or 4 years after the war ended, and they replaced it with the title of Rear Admiral Lower Half. What a horrible rank, but that still exists today. So the title of Commodore has since gone back to position authority of a senior captain still in charge of multiple ships or squadrons. And there were a few years in the 80s when the rank of Commodore actually came back, but it was very short-lived and returned to the current state. So if we take the history that we know from the U.S. and from the British fleet, in Star Trek, in the 60s, Commodores were a flag rank. They were essentially a one-star admiral. They were aligned to how the U.S. Navy was during World War II. What was interesting, though, is that in Star Trek, there was also a rank known as fleet captain. Now, there was never such a rank in the British or U.S. navies. And if the writers had been consistent in how they did things, then you would have thought that both Fleet Captain Pike and Fleet Captain Garth should have been Commodores. Do you feel the same way there, Jeff?
Yeah, I'm thinking maybe they were trying to have it both ways, where Commodore was effectively the Rear Admiral Lower Half, and they then had the distinction Fleet Captain for the senior captains of a group, because now Commodore was already taken for a rank.
Oh, that makes sense. Okay, because I was looking at some of the uniforms, and it looked like their arm insignias were pretty similar. Was there a distinction that you're aware of?
Not that I can recall.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. It's actually a pretty cool rank. That wouldn't be a bad title for anybody. So what we're going to do now is we're going to talk about some of the key Commodores that played major roles within the series. And we're going to start off with Commodore Met Decker, commanding officer of the USS Constellation. So, Jeff, what were your impressions of Commodore Met Decker and the episode Doomsday Machine?
Well, we definitely didn't catch him at his best. He had suffered a pretty significant loss, and he had pretty thoroughly cracked at that point that we finally got to see him. So I can see the comparisons to Captain Ahab. I mean, that's pretty apparent. Mm-hmm. But the Decker that everyone else knew in the Starfleet, in the Star Trek universe, the one that was famous as being just this exceptional captain, we never got to see him in the episode, and I felt that was kind of unfortunate, because I would have liked to have seen him at one point, you know, when he was going out and exploring with his crew.
Oh, absolutely. I think when I used to watch Star Trek as a kid, and even now today, anytime they came across another vessel, it was always pretty cool. It was always a Constitution class. And when they came across the Constellation and it was all beat up, it was pretty scary. But I have to say that the actor, William Wyndham, who played him, did an outstanding job. I mean, you could tell, and he was very believable, battle-rattled, extremely emotional, and, you know, did what would any good commander would do in a crisis, which, you know, is to allow his crew a chance to live, and then makes the ultimate mistake in seeing the planet that he beamed his entire crew down to survive get destroyed, and then he becomes the lone survivor. And I don't know how mm-hmm. anybody wouldn't Absolutely. Crack under that kind of pressure. William Wyndham came on too. He could definitely, he had great expressions. He had a very solid, and he had such a deep voice. I mean, he had this air of authority with him that you could see through what he once was, I think, pretty easily. But as I was researching this, I found it interesting that they had originally cast it for a stronger actor. I don't remember who the name was. And that he was a bit more aggressive and a bit more over the top. And they actually toned him down quite a bit when they hired William Wyndham, which I could easily see him playing a very dramatic, over-the-top Commodore Decker. I mean, he was pretty much to me during that episode. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, that was an interesting bit of casting there. But I think they made the best choice going with William Wyndham, because I just, maybe it's just 50 years of seeing him in the role, but I just can't picture anyone else doing it. He just nailed it.
He did. And you know what? He was one of those guys too, who, as time went on, he aged very well, didn't he?
Oh yeah.
I remember seeing him
in one of the Phase 2 New Voyages fan films. And he was reprising his role basically when the story was that when he went into the Doomsday Machine, the explosion actually caused like a space-time rift, and he got sent back in time to Earth. And so he ends up stranded on Earth in the 20th century. And
oh, yeah?
Kirk has to go back in time, and they find him. And they made really good use of the one fan that had the shuttlecraft in his garage, because they open up the garage and there's the shuttlecraft.
That's pretty cool.
And they get a recorded video message from Commodore Decker, and it's in a much older William Wyndham.
Oh, that's pretty neat. I just thought the world of him, especially as he went on. And I remember, I'm pretty sure he did a few audiobooks too for mm-hmm. Star Trek. And his voice is very distinct and just carries on well. So I know, I think he passed not that long ago, probably 5 or 6 years ago now. He was pretty old, but he looked great and just had an air about him. If you wanted to play Commodore, I think they nailed it with William Wyndham. And then the other aspect of this, Jeff, is that we presume that he was the dad of Will Decker from Star Trek The Motion Picture.
Yeah, all the behind-the-scenes information that was coming out when they were leading up to releasing the film, they're talking about Will Decker, and they linked him pretty specifically to Matt Decker. They just never explicitly said it in the movie. But all the other...
No, they never
all
did.
All the other tie-in media all had... You know, had the link there. It was like in their press releases and all this other stuff, and it made its way into the novels and the comics and everything.
So I did read the novelization, but it has been many years. Did they mention it in that? Do you remember at all?
I don't recall. It's been probably more a good decade since I read the novelization of motion picture.
Yeah, and I was just trying to think back to it, but I thought that would have been something that could have been called out during the movie too, to make just a little bit more drama there and make it just a tad more interesting. Because if you didn't know who he was, and probably the pain on one part that Kirk had to relieve him in the first place would have played a little bit further. And you know, if that had been mentioned, I guess maybe when they were eyeball to eyeball. And Will Decker was kind of accusing him of, you know, just letting his own ego take over, and that he had no intention of giving him the ship. I think that would have been a very dramatic scene that would have kind of harkened back to all the fans a little bit.
Yeah, that would have been a good spot to throw it in. Just kind of throw it in Kirk's face, you know, something like, you know, I'm not my father, or you know, something like that.
Or you didn't save him, yeah. Something along those lines. Yeah. So it would have been interesting. Okay. Anything else on Commodore Decker before we move to our next Commodore, sir?
I think this is a good opportunity to move on.
Okay. So the next one that we are going to talk about is Commodore Bob Wesley. He was the commanding officer of the USS Lexington and in charge of a squadron testing the capabilities of the M5 computer aboard the Enterprise. So, Jeff, what are your thoughts of Commodore Wesley and even the episode Ultimate Computer?
Well, like you were saying, the Commodore Wesley was commanding the Lexington, and he was in the war games against the Enterprise, which was being controlled by the M5 computer. And it was interesting to note that his character was in favor of having the computers taking over the ships to reduce the risk men and women in Starfleet.
Yeah, he definitely yeah. was. He was. You know, I'll tell you. For he also the actor who played him, and I don't who know. I'll have to look up who that was. Did a real fair job with it, and he had a definite command presence about him, a very mature presence of him. I also like the way he kind of rubbed it in with Kirk. What do you call him, Captain Dunzel? If I remember right.
Yeah. He threw that in, and McCoy had to ask what a dunzel was.
And what was a dunzel, Jeff?
I don't remember Spock's exact words, but it was effectively a useless piece of equipment.
That's right. And that changed. So anyway, yeah, I think the great part about this was that there was definitely a familiarity between Commodore Wesley and Captain Kirk, and that seemed to be the case. I always got a kick out of it in all the series that everybody in a senior officer rank seemed to know everybody else in your senior officer rank. But I guess it was a pretty exclusive club until we started to see just how many ships were actually out there. But these guys played off very well. And, you know, here's, you know, this would have been a great stump, Mr. Atos. So can you remember the other ships in the squadron? I remember the Excalibur, but I can't remember the other ship.
I know there was the Lexington, the Excalibur. This would be an excellent stump Mr. Atos question, though.
Yeah, I didn't get too far into it. I think I remember Excalibur because it was also part of a fan film, and that's the only reason I remembered it. But there was...
I think it was Exeter and...
Was there more than three?
There were four, of them.
Oh, okay. Exeter is right. Yeah. I'm pretty sure you're right about that. Okay. Well, that'll be something for everybody to weigh in on the Babel conference and give us that other ship's name. So we have Lexington, Excalibur, and Exeter so far. So what were the other ships? And I don't even know if they were all mentioned, to be honest with you. I haven't seen that episode in a while. Great episode,
though,
overall.
I don't think they were all shown on screen. I know the remastered edition. It was the Hood. That's what it was.
Ah, there we go. Forget it, Babel Conference people.
Yeah, I knew I would remember it. But there were some shots where they added it in so that you could see the hull and registry numbers.
Oh, they did. Okay.
But the original one, it was just longer shots because they were reusing the same miniature.
Yeah. It looked like they just superimposed three or four Enterprises coming at them. And then was it the... was it the same shot of the Constellation when the Excalibur was just kind of adrift?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah. And I do remember here, too, you know, going back to Doomsday Machine, if I remember right, the Constellation was one of those ATM models. Because they didn't have the money to make another ship, so they literally took a model off the shelf and beat the crap out of it.
Yeah, they put it together and they like took a lighter to it.
Is that what it was, a lighter?
I mean, if you look at the way it's warped, you can tell it was a lighter on the end of the nacelles.
The size of the Constellation looked very similar to the size of the shuttle. It was entering the maw of the Doomsday
Machine. Yeah, that was, I think, more for the benefit of the audience, because it was... if they'd done that to scale, the thing would have been a tiny speck in the maw of the Doomsday Machine.
I know. Hey, we love the show. We also like to tease some of the things that they did, and it was all in good fun and good storytelling. But getting back to Commodore Wesley, now he comes back, but is it in a novel or the animated series, Jeff?
Well, Commodore Wesley came back in the animated series, and this time he was a civilian, and he was the governor of Mantilles. So, I mean, I have to wonder if what happened here at this weapons test caused him to go into early retirement and possibly run for a civilian office.
Yeah, it could be. It's not a good thing when you command a bunch of ships and you back a program and then many people die. Yeah. So,
another,
could have been.
Another interesting thing, though, is the actor, I believe his name was Barry Russo.
Okay.
He had previously appeared on Star Trek, and he was Security Chief Giotto on Devil in the Dark, I believe.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So he was the Enterprise Security Chief, and that was the only time we ever saw the Enterprise Security Chief.
Yeah, I guess so. He did a lousy job, that Security Chief, whoever he was. Yeah. That's all I know.
Yeah. Well, he went from Lieutenant Commander Giotto to Commodore Wesley, so...
Yeah, he did okay. But you know, there's another connection here, right? So we were talking about the episode, The Ultimate Computer, mm-hmm. where there was Dr. Richard Daystrom. Mm-hmm. And he was played by Percy Rodriguez. And Percy Rodriguez also played?
Commodore Stone.
Commodore Stone. That's right. You want to tell us a little bit about Commodore Stone?
Commodore Stone was the commander of Starbase 11. Although I believe it was like the very next episode was had a also at Starbase 11 with a totally different commanding officer. So maybe it was just the end of his... tour there, and like the very next episode we had change of command in between episodes or something. But he was he oversaw the court-martial of Captain Kirk in the apparent death of Lieutenant Commander Ben Finney. And apparently I see in the notes here you put that he played the also did the voice for the trailers for Jaws, which was your favorite movie.
I have to say Jaws is definitely my favorite movie. I have pinged on Matt Rushing a couple times in the 602 Club. He's at different times I was trying to get on the show, or he asked me to come on. It was on either a subject I knew nothing about or our schedules just didn't work. And it wasn't too often, but anyway, I did say, hey, Jaws is my favorite movie. Could we do one on Jaws? And I think he said yes, but I think that was sometime last year or maybe the year before. So I think his schedule is a little bit full. But I was watching I've read every book about Jaws and have seen every documentary. And when they interviewed Percy Rodriguez, now when I saw the trailers and everything, I had no idea because he had this very deep, ominous voice. I wouldn't even attempt to try to imitate, and it was incredible. And he did both Jaws and Jaws 2, and he just had that, that voice. What I'll do is I'll see if I can find a wave. I'll throw it in here, and people can hear it for himself. He had a great, great speaking voice. I'm sure he did many other trailers that I'm unaware of, but because I saw it in that documentary and saw him, I don't know if he's I don't think he's still around, but and if you are, I'm really sorry, Mr. Rodriguez, but just an incredible voice. And he has a presence himself, both in as Dr. Daystrom and as Commodore Stone. Very, very imposing figure.
Yeah, I wouldn't, if he is still around, I'd like to see him to take a crack at that mock trailer that someone did for Jaws 19 last year?
Jaws 19? Okay. I don't think I've caught that.
Yeah, it was from Back to the Future 2. They had Jaws 19 with the holographic shark that attacked Marty. And
Yes.
And so last year, somebody, because it was 2015, was when the movie was the future part of the movie, they did a fake trailer for Jaws 19, listing all the other Jaws movies leading up to that. And it was pretty ridiculous. I mean, some of them were right up there with Sharknado.
Beautiful. Yeah, I'll definitely check that out. But as far as Commodore Stone's character, I don't think he had a ton of screen time. I'm trying to remember to the episode a little bit more specifically.
He was basically just in there as kind of like a generic judge type figure. We really didn't get a whole lot with him.
I guess not. And one thing I'll say too, though, that kind of shows, and we were talking about this a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about the Balance of Terror. You know, there was a lot of good diversity, and you know, from African Americans and Latinos and women and so forth and so on back in the mid '60s, with an awful lot of power and in very prominent roles. And in this case, in both cases, you know, Percy Rodriguez played two very pivotal characters. I think one from the Ultimate Computer as Dr. Daystrom. Of course, he didn't have a great ending in that, but he was a genius. And we do know that there was the Daystrom Institute named after him, and he had designed all the computers for all the ships in the fleet, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, his Duotronic systems were what they were using on the ship at that point.
That's right. And then obviously, anytime you're playing somebody who's senior to James T. Kirk in any role, you know, if Captain Kirk has to call you sir, you're doing okay. That's the way I look at it anyway.
And he was in a position to end Kirk's career right then too.
Yeah, he was. He was. And you know, I wonder if he also had to resign because he almost sent the Enterprise spinning into oblivion there because he didn't believe that the computer had been manipulated, and the way they found out was a little bit over the top, but I guess it was effective. All right, so moving on, our next Commodore, Jeff, Commodore Mendez from the episode The Cage, or The Menagerie, excuse me, The Menagerie.
Yeah, once again, we're at Starbase 11, and now we have a totally different Commodore in charge there. But one thing I did notice was Commodore Stone wore a red shirt, Commodore Mendez wore a gold shirt. Maybe they were both assigned in different areas of the Starbase. That's another possibility.
It is. It could have been that, and I guess it was never really stated that Stone was the commanding officer of Starbase 11. Could have been. I just don't remember. But you're right. He could have been a JAG officer, which would preclude him from commanding a Starbase. So yeah, it could be.
Yeah, because when Mendez was serving on the court-martial board for Commander Spock, he was just kind of thrown in there because he was one of the highest ranking officers on the ship and there was nobody else. But Stone, it was a full court martial that had been convened and he was the senior JAG officer there. So I can see the difference.
Yeah. Yeah. That actually makes sense. It does make sense. Yeah. Of course.
And then from a behind the scenes angle too, I mean, there's another aspect to it as well because the guy who played Commodore Mendez, also Malachi Throne, he also provided the voice of the Keeper for The Cage, and they had new dialogue for the Keeper at the end of this episode, so that necessitated bringing back Malachi Throne, and they figured, well, while we're at it, why not have him play the Commodore?
Yeah. Oh, that makes sense. What an awesome name, Malachi Throne. You think that was a stage name?
Possibly.
I mean, that's pretty unique, but very, again, it definitely grabs your attention, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So we also know that Commodore Mendez too wound up, I guess being an illusion, a hologram. What was he exactly?
He was a mental projection by the Talosians, mm-hmm. but he was a real person at the Starbase, because when we first saw him at the Starbase, it was really him. It was only when he was on the shuttle with Kirk and on the Enterprise that he was the illusion.
That makes sense. All right, yeah, I was always kind of curious about that. And the way that ended, too, I guess my question was, why did they just go all through all that? If I guess they just wanted to have a record that would exonerate Spock once they did get back to the real Commodore Mendez,
yeah,
I suppose.
It was all being broadcast live back to Mendez back at the Starbase, and he was seeing it all on his monitor and couldn't shut it off.
Did they show that? I'm trying to remember.
It was Uhura made a comment at the end of the episode, like she was saying that she got a message from the Starbase saying that they had been receiving that as well.
Ah, okay. So that's how Spock got to continue on with his career, huh?
Mm-hmm.
We were lucky.
And we, you know, it's Norm's favorite movie, and it's one of my favorite movies, but there is also a Last Starfighter connection here, too.
I'm listening.
Commodore Mendez provided the voice of the Keeper. The body of the Keeper was Meg, I'm not sure how to pronounce her last name, but it's Wiley, Meg
okay.
Wiley. She played Granny in The Last Starfighter.
She did?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Well, there's the connection, folks. All right. Now, I said my favorite movie of all time was Jaws. Your favorite movie of all time was The Last Starfighter. Is that right?
Well, it's Norm's, or one of Norm's. I'm not sure if it's his absolute favorite, but it's definitely up there in my top 10.
Yeah. I enjoyed it, too. It was definitely a good movie, and I catch it probably once every 2 or 3 years. I find it again, and it's kind of a good romp. It's very 80s, so mm-hmm. It's fun in that way.
And Norm and I were coming up with ways that they could bring it back and do like a reimagining of it.
Yeah. Now, that would have been after Tron, I guess, but probably
yes.
One of the first all-around CGI.
It was just like a couple of years after Tron, I think.
Okay.
Because I think Tron was like 82, 80? And this was 84.
Okay. Yeah, I do remember that, and I remember it being very being cleverly made with CGI. See, we digress again.
Mm-hmm.
You just never know where we're going to go. Okay. All right. So, Jeff, how about this? Now, we talked, I think, about the major Commodores in the show and what they added. And these were the guys that, you know, really had tangible roles to a certain level. Let's open up that Trekopedia knowledge of yours and talk about some of the other Commodores that appeared or were heard on Star Trek, the original series.
Well, I think it's really important to bring up Commodore Stocker from, I believe it was The Deadly Years,
mm-hmm.
Which I don't recall. I think it was a third season episode when Kirk and Chekov and McCoy get infected with the aging virus.
Right.
And Commodore Stocker, they were transporting him to Starbase 10, which he was taking over as the commanding officer there. And Kirk and the others get incapacitated. Their situation is deteriorating. And Stocker takes command of the Enterprise, and he tries to take a shortcut through the Romulan neutral zone to get to Starbase 10 faster, only for the ship to get attacked by a bunch of Romulan ships.
Not a good day for Commodore Stocker. And a good lesson to all our Star Trekkies out there, Star Trekker fans. Never let a Commodore take command of your vessel.
It never seemed to work out well when it happened on the Enterprise.
Not on the Enterprise, or even when other Commodores were in charge. They seemed to get into a little bit of trouble. Okay. Who else is out there, Jeff?
And it apparently he did end up assuming command of Starbase 10. They didn't, like, bust him down and take away his command after that, shockingly. But in Voyager, there was a reference on screen that his assumption of command there was a precedent in Federation legal history.
Is that so? I didn't realize that. So they go back to this episode. They go back to the Deadlands.
Yeah, they made a reference to this episode in the Voyager episode "Tinker Tinner, Doctor Spy."
Do you think
there was Commodore?
Do you think the team at To the Journey realized that?
I don't know.
Okay.
It was a very, very obscure reference, and you know, blink and you'll miss it.
Okay.
It was on one of the view screens, like some of the accoutogram data.
Oh, okay. So it wasn't set out right? It was something you could see in the background?
Yeah. All
right. I think that would be pushing them then to expect.
Yeah.
Okay. When you said reference, I thought it was spoken openly. Okay. Yeah, there's a lot of things they put out there.
Yeah, Voyager did have an open reference to the original series in the episode Q2. Icheb was giving an oral presentation on Kirk's 5-year mission to Janeway, and that's where they finally established that the 5-year mission was from 2265 to 2270.
Oh, okay. So that locked it down officially then, all those years later. Okay.
7th season of Voyager, they finally did.
Okay. And by that point, had Akuta's book come out already with different timelines?
Actually, at that point, that even actually contradicted the Akuta chronology.
It did or it didn't? I'm sorry.
It did.
It did. Okay.
Because their chronology had it precisely 200 years after it aired, or 300 years. Misspoke there.
Okay.
But it had it precisely 300 years after the episode aired, so that the first season started in 2267, but then Voyager comes along and says, no, it was 2265.
You learn a lot from this show, folks. I know I do every time. And I actually take these notes because I have a feeling this information will circle back.
Yeah, and...
All right.
Then another important Commodore that we saw was Commodore Barstow. He was played by Richard Durr. Or Dare. I'm not sure exactly how you pronounce his last name. And that was from the episode The Alternative Factor, when reality was winking out from the crossover between the antimatter universe from Lazarus. And he had ordered all other ships to withdraw from within 100 parsecs of the planet where this was going on, and then ordered the Enterprise to go in and check it out. And that was at the beginning of the episode. Commodore Travers from Arena.
He
was the commander of the outpost on Cestus III, and Kirk was saying that he was famous for his hospitality, and because of privilege of rank, he had a personal chef with him at the colony. But then, as we get into the episode, we find out the colony had been destroyed, and these messages they'd been getting from the Commodore were faked by the Gorn, and so he was presumably killed there.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that was... That was the big setup in the beginning. I had forgotten, though, that it had been a Commodore that they were talking about until you mentioned it earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Okay.
And then one other was from the Ultimate Computer again. We had two Commodores in that episode commanding the Starbase. Starbase 6 was Commodore Enright. And he ordered the Enterprise to the station where they took on the M5 computer. And we never saw him on screen, but we heard his voice, and that was provided by James Doohan.
Excellent. Okay. So
and he did a ton of voices, even on the original series too.
Yeah, you know, it's funny as time goes on, and the more I read about things in the past, or you know, listening to Saturday Morning Trek too, it is amazing how many voices James Doohan did.
Oh, he did like 2/3 of the animated series.
Yeah, he did. Have you ever seen him live? Were you around? Did you ever see him in a convention?
I never got to see him live. I have an autographed photo that someone else got for me, but I never got to meet him.
Well, one of the things he did, which I thought was very clever, I don't know if there's a YouTube of it out there, but I guess it was very common when he was doing the different conventions, is he would do several different voices of what the engineer would be given the ethnicity. You know, so he would do Spanish, he'd do Russian, he'd do them all. And so they, you know, they'd set him up with, you know, Kirk to engineering, and then he would answer in those different dialects. And he had quite a range, a very impressive range. In fact, you know, it hearing him do some of those other accents, including English, and others, I was thinking that Scottish probably wasn't in his top 5. That's how good he was, you know. And I know people make fun of his Scottish accent all the time, but he pulled it off just fine, I thought, you know. But just interesting that he did that voice of Commodore Travers. All right, I think that's pretty much it. I know there were some references in Star Trek: The Motion Picture, and there were some references only in TNG during, was it Conspiracy?
Yeah, there were some, like, from a readout that Data was reading off in that episode, but that was the only time you ever saw Commodore outside of the original series and Enterprise.
Yeah, so it's funny how that title was so common back in the 1960s and in the original series, but it didn't translate. And you know, even in the service today, you know, I served under a Commodore. He was a captain, and I was his command senior chief. And we were in charge, but he was in charge of several squadrons, and that's how he had that title. But even today, even though I've been retired for a long time and he's been retired for a long time and we're very close friends, I still refer to him as Commodore. However, I try to do it in my best Captain Jack Sparrow voice, because I would always kind of pinch him there. Commodore, you know, just to have fun with him. But that's my Commodore story. I digress. All right. So,
well, I got...
you got some more?
I got my own Commodore story.
All right. Let's go. Let's hear it.
Well, my family was a Navy dynasty for a very long time, up until my grandfather was the black sheep and joined up with the Army Air Corps.
How dare he?
Yeah. And then a year later, it split off from the Army and became the Air Force. Mm-hmm. And it's been an Air Force family ever since. But up before that, it was a Navy dynasty. And in the War of 1812, we had Commodore John Rodgers. Mm-hmm. And then his grandson during the Civil War was Commodore and later Admiral John Rodgers. And there was also another Commander John Rodgers who worked with the Wright brothers. But you can see a pattern in the names in the family there. But we had several admirals, and we actually found a photo of the Civil War era John Rodgers, and it looks just like my father with less hair.
Oh, yeah? Now, do you look like your dad at all, too? Or?
And I look like my dad as well. So it's a very, very strong family resemblance. It kind of reminds me of people that were making fun of the episode of Voyager where they had Kate Mulgrew playing her ancestor in 1999. Mm-hmm. But it's about the same amount of time difference, and it looks like me about 20 or 30 years older.
That's pretty cool. Wow. So your grandfather, your dad, and yourself all went Air Force. Is that right?
And my brothers and my aunts and my uncles and my cousins.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Boy, they really jumped aside. And here you are.
Yeah. And then my one of my sisters was the black sheep, and she went in the Army and then married a Marine.
Okay, that's quite a lineage you got there.
But it was a Navy family primarily. There were also other parts of the family that were Army and such, mostly during the Civil War.
I see. Well, it's nice that you can track your family history. That's that's a pretty neat trait, and to know it to that degree, you know, the only real distant relative we had that was famous was Douglas MacArthur. My mother's maiden name is MacArthur, and I forget what level of cousin he was to the group. Of course, he was Army, and I've been Navy all the way, and my family's been Navy all the way for a very, very long time. That's pretty cool. Excellent. Well, that's a good lineage. So you were directly related to two Commodores, one that went on to become an Admiral.
Yes.
Excellent. Okay.
Yeah, and both of whom have also had about six ships named after them.
That's impressive as well.
So there were like, I think, three USS Rogers and three USS John Rogers. Mm-hmm. And I've always wanted to see that name pop up in Star Trek somewhere, because, I mean, there are that many ships in the U.S. Navy, and as many other ship names have carried over from the U.S. Navy to the Star Trek.
So, Jeff, I got to know, I mean, even though your family kind of went over to the Air Force, you being a Star Trek fan... And let's face it, I mean, Starfleet essentially is the Federation Navy, humanitarian armada and all that stuff, but it's still the Federation's Navy. You have this lineage of having ship names after you. No draw to the Navy at all? No shot at having a USS Harlan out there one day?
No, it never really appealed to me. I was always more interested in the Air Force.
Okay. Is there a USS Harlan in any of your fanfic?
No.
Not yet. Okay.
No, but I have used John Rogers as the name of several of my ships on Star Trek Online.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Okay. So I think that gets us through all the Commodores for the original series. So are we ready to move on to our next segment, Mr. Atos?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. Hailing frequencies open, please.
Hailing frequencies are open.
Okay. This past week, we received a lot of great comments on the Babel Conference, and Norm, Jeff, and I would really like to thank everyone for their participation and feedback. The amount of traffic and volume that has been coming through has been incredible, and like I say, it is extraordinarily humbling to see that, and we appreciate the feedback. We truly do, because it makes us really want to do better week after week and prepare even harder for our show so that we can bring good entertainment to you. And another nice event that occurred and was unbelievable was 2 5-star reviews that we received from Chris Baca and Greg Malumbi. Thank you, guys. I mean, we here at Standard Orbit, we take those comments really to heart. And when I say that we want to continuously improve, we do. So while we enjoy all the praise, we also like to hear good constructive feedback, too, on how we can do things better. Because without improving and without trying to make it better each and every week, you start to get stale. And we certainly don't want that to happen. We want to continue to always look for some exciting topics, do the due diligence, the right amount of research, and come in and try to be as entertaining as possible. And, you know, we always try to hit it out of the park. I know we don't always succeed, but we continually want to succeed. So your feedback is vital. And so, you know, I'm a little sensitive, but Jeff's like a rock. So go ahead, just hit us with whatever you have for constructive criticism, and we'll listen and always try to do better. So we are going to try to stump Mr. Atos. Now, Ian Kimmins sent me a very unique and unusual question. This is really going to test you, because it's not so much just a Star Trek question as, you know, it's almost those people that have unbelievable photographic memories and can recall days and dates. So when I told you that he came up with a good one, he came up with a good one. So are you ready? Have you had enough vitamin C? You charged up?
I am about as good as I'm going to get.
Okay. So here we go, Jeff. What was the day and the date of the first day of filming of The Cage?
I know it was 1964, I believe, but I don't remember the exact date.
Oh, okay. So what I will do is I will have Ian send me his IM information, and I will, I guess, get him the shirt of his choice from Redbubble, because we missed it. It was definitely 1964.
Friday, 27 November.
Very good job, Ian. You finally stumped Mr. Atos. I think the spirit of the question was very, very difficult, because it wasn't, I guess, directly related to Star Trek within the universe piece of it. More of a timeline. But hey, we said make it difficult. And Ian, you did just that, because I when I first read the question, I said, oh, there's no way. And He did.
Yeah, I'm not as up on the real world production side of it.
Yeah, that's okay. So we left the rules wide open. We just said to try and stump you, and they did. So we'll play it fair. So as we move on, any final thoughts about the Commodores, Mr. Atos?
No, I think we've done a pretty good job covering it. I'm really interested to seeing what everyone else on the Babel Conference has to add on this.
Yeah, there's always more information to come, and the responses there have been incredible. But I will say this, it's been a lot of fun talking about the Commodores, and this is just one of the Trek topics we've been talking about on Trek FM this week. Here's a quick look at what you might have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, the Orb.
The Wadi, a fun-loving race from the Gamma Quadrant, arrive at DS9 eager to play a game with Sisko and the crew, one that appears to be a matter of life and death. All right, so are we moving along, Matthew?
Oh, we're moving along.
The Ready Room.
He's carrying in the lamb chop sock puppet saying,
She stayed at her post.
While Charlie Horse ran.
While Charlie Horse ran.
To the journey! And then sexiness ensues, and it's a slow dissolve to the next morning.
Fantastic. Okay. Check. Janeway gets some.
Check. Janeway gets some. Confirmed. Commentary. Trek stars.
You know, you come up with something stupid because of some joke that someone said and someone else said, and then all of a sudden you're doing a tournament of movies which J.J. Abrams produced to determine which one is the crappiest.
Women at Warp.
AF, which are the initials that Picard carved into Boothby's tree back on Starfleet Academy, and that is how he met Boothby the groundskeeper.
Well, we never did learn Boothby's first and second name, did we? It was all a ploy to get to hang out with Boothby.
Meta Trex.
What I find most interesting is that when Deanna suggests it, Riker doesn't say, "What? That's a crazy idea," or "I've never thought about that." He's just like, "Oh, okay, good idea." And like, it's a normal thing.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a normal thing to call up something in the holodeck and kind of work through it or live through it.
Melodic Trex.
The reason why I think Brian Reitzel would be a more plausible choice is because he has worked with Fuller in the past. They worked together on Hannibal. He scored that series, all 39 episodes. The neat thing about Brian Reitzel's music is it's more of a sound design than it is a score.
Saturday Morning Trek.
Chekhov was in the first season, but he was working on the third deck behind the boiler room and was ill with a condition called Malaprovsky's malady, which is a kind of 23rd century version of Montezuma's revenge, and was hidden in the bathroom, ensconced there for hours and hours, while poor Mr. Khan's genetically engineered kidneys, about to explode, pounded pitifully on the door, begging to be let in, until finally the door opens, Chekhov steps out, Khan looks at him and says, "Your face, I remember."
That's the best explanation I've ever heard.
you get the idea that I've told this story before.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So, Jeff, if you could you tell our listeners on how they can access our avenues to Trek FM?
Well, you can find us on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Windows Phone. And of course, you can always stream or download the MP3 file from our website at Trek.fm, and you can grab the RSS link there as well. And if you're an Apple user, please be sure to hit the subscribe button. That makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes, and it helps us to increase our visibility for new listeners.
One of the ways our listeners can help us out is becoming a patron by joining Patreon. Now, what is Patreon? Patreon.com is our way of funding the network. We are a fan-supported, listener-supported network, and for us to keep shows coming in order to buy the equipment we need, buy and hold all the bandwidth, the service to download, it gets very expensive. So we ask for our fans to help us out, but we don't do it without giving you some things in return besides outstanding shows. We also have different incentives, and we have different perks for you as a patron. So for $15 a month, you can join the Patrons Roundtable. Now, the Patrons Roundtable is an awesome place for for any of the patrons who subscribe for that $15 amount to come in and actually do a podcast with several of the hosts from Trek FM. Now, Jeff, I think, if I remember, you and I were on the original one.
Yeah, I was on the first three or four of them. I haven't really been able to join in on any others recently, but I was on those first few.
Yeah, I remember being on the first one. It was actually with you and Norm. What a coincidence, and Will Wynn at the time. So that was that was pretty unique. And now look at us. That's scary, huh? So beyond that, so for $25 a month, you could be an associate producer on the episode, on the show of your choice. So that is also an outstanding perk, and that really helps us move it along. And then incrementally, you know, just for signing up and doing whatever you can help us out with, you can get into the patron zone, which allows you to get early access feeds to a lot of our shows and a lot of neat things that both Chris and Aaron Harvey has put in there for you to download in the patron section. So there's a lot of incentive to do it, but mostly it really does help out the network, and we really appreciate your ability to help us out. And if you want to wear your Trek FM fandom, you can also find great Trek FM themed merchandise at redbubble.com. Just type in Trek FM into the search field, and just like I'll be doing for Ian very shortly once he sends me specifically what shirt he wants, going in there and ordering from Redbubble and shipping it to him. So I think that that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, I really enjoy those shirts, and I have a couple of them myself, and I really enjoy just taking them out, wearing them out, and having them as conversation starters with people who've never heard of the network.
Mm-hmm. And Jeff, could you also tell us a little bit about the Babel Conference?
It's a very informal and a very respectful place where we can just all just kind of hang out and we can just talk about our fandoms together.
We also want to take this time to thank our associate producers for Standard Orbit. Without them, we could not continue to bring you this show. I mean, they provide so much support, and we thank Renee Roberts and Richard Rudledge. I mean, it's one of those things where, and I know exactly where you're coming from, where, you know, you're proud to put your name on something that you really support and really enjoy. And because of your support, we're able to bring the show to so many other people. So thank you both, Renee, and thank you, Richard. And you can find Renee on Twitter at MRES_1701 and Richard at RUT8972. So in addition, if you want to find us on the interwebs, please, you can find me on the Babel Conference all the time. That's where I hang out, and that's where I really enjoy finding more information and engaging all of the people on the network. And Jeff, where can we find you on the interwebs?
All right, if you'd like to get in touch with us here at Trek FM, you can always find us on trekfm.com/contact and look in the sidebar on the show page. Or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm and leave us a voice message. You can also contact us through Twitter at TrekFM, Facebook.com/TrekFM, and as I mentioned earlier, the Babel Conference. Just type the Babel Conference as B-A-B-E-L into the search field on Facebook, or go to the website at TrekFM and click Discussion on the menu bar. Now, if you don't have access to an Atavicron, you can always find me on the Babel Conference on Facebook. I'm also on Twitter at Harlander, and as a supporter of the network through Patreon. I'm also the co-host, not only here on Standard Orbit, but also on Warp 5. And you can check out my website. It's been called The Grand Unified Theory of Star Trek, and that's at trekopedia.com. So join us next week for another exciting episode of Standard Orbit.